Hello, it's the podcast. I'm Christian Corley. That's James McLean. Welcome. We're without Brian Terranova this week, because unfortunately Brian is he's been up late filming. I'm not sure what he's been filming. Has he been casting the X-Files?
He wishes. Very much so. Every day.
Yeah.
Under his bed, crying.
we were hoping he'd be telling us this week. And if he was here, we'd probably be doing this live as well. And we had hoped he'd be telling us exactly what he's up to this week. But because he's had such a late night, I think it was 4 a.m. his time when he messaged me earlier. And he was still hadn't driven home. No Brian this week. So we're doing it in the old-fashioned pre-recording. In fact, we're doing it proper old school. We're not even bothering with sound effects this week. You'll get sound effects, don't worry about it. We won't get the sound effects.
Which is good, because you always...
screw them up.
Yeah. I was trying to think of a particularly non-profane to say, but the
you're
F-word just kept coming to my mouth.
No. Well, you know, you say that as if, he does it from time to time, the listener's probably only thinking. And yeah, in fairness, I probably only did screw it up a couple of times. But what you don't hear is that the tool that I used in a very, very kind of... you obviously don't care about it, but basically I was using numbers and capital letters and things for the buttons that would play the various sound clips. And occasionally I would like press shift and one for an exclamation, but it wouldn't pick up the shift, it would just pick up the one. So if I was talking about the podcast on Twitter or on Facebook, then something would play when I pressed shift and then a number. So it was an absolutely useless tool. So that's most of my errors. But talking about errors with podcasts and things like that, James will know this, and you may know that I've been on a couple of radio shows in my local area talking about gadgety tech related stuff, as I do for my day job. And I was given, incredibly, I know, my own show for an hour. Yeah, thank you. On Zetland FM, which it goes out live online, but there's no you can't like catch up later. But I have put my shows on the dialogue for my shows on SoundCloud, so you can listen to that. And the other night I did my very first link. And with me in the studio was the guest that I was going to be speaking to and the guy who runs the station. And he said it was a fantastic link for a first link. Unfortunately, I'd forgot to put the microphone on.
I saw a comment something about that.
So there was like 15 seconds of silence while I did a link, and then the next track, then I pressed play for the next track. So, these things, first go, you know.
Did you go home and then sort of slide under the bed and cry alongside her?
No, I'd forgotten about it. And I don't cohabit with Brian either, so...
No, but I think for the listeners, it's kind of fun to imagine you do. Sort of like a Bert and Ernie sort of thing.
Bert and Ernie, yes. Hey, Bert, yes. We're here to talk about Before the Flood, the fourth episode of Doctor Who Series 9, which is in a kind of basic kind of overview sort of a way, I was very happy with. I'm still not satisfied with the time slot. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. And I have a vague idea of how James took to it. But before that, there's this kind of thing that we probably should talk about a little briefly, which is the kind of conscious uncoupling, the divorce from Casterbus.com.
Right, yes.
Yeah, so basically... And I think we alluded to some sort of disharmony that I was feeling within Doctor Who.
Slightly, yes.
The last time I was here for a full podcast, yeah, when we did our live one a couple of weeks ago. And I basically decided that I'd had enough of running a website and not feeling I was given a fair crack of the whip that other websites were being given in terms of being able to deliver the best quality to the readers. There isn't another during my 11 years running Casterbus.com, there was not another Doctor Who website that was issuing the same volume of quality of in the same volume of articles, full stop, but certainly not the same volume of quantity and of quality. And I believe that the team that we have there at the moment is probably the best team we'd have there throughout the time. We've had brilliant writers, but at the moment the team that's ready and waiting to start writing once the site starts back up again, which I imagine is in the next few days, are an absolutely fantastic collection of writers. And which is one of the reasons why we did the fan fiction, because I felt that the writers could do it, whereas maybe 5 years ago there wasn't enough of us and there wasn't enough good writers to be able to do that. So, not being able to give a fair crack of the whip, I decided that, and the circumstances, which, you know, if you listen to the last time I was on the podcast when we did the live one, that's, it'll give you an idea of how I felt about it. So just, I move on, the site can continue and go in whatever direction it wants to, and I can continue having a good time with Doctor Who, with Brian and James, and not feel as if I'm kind of getting very angry and cross and disillusioned with a show that perhaps I'm more personally involved with than I should have been. And that's more or less it, really. Anything to add to that, James?
No, not really. I mean, I think, wow. It obviously was very trite. I think your allusion to Tegan was quite a good one. Is it, you know, in the end, when it stops becoming fun anymore, you just got to call it a day.
Yeah.
And these sort of things, as I think we've said before, I know I've said several times, is the fandom and professionalism never mixes very well, and unfortunately it happens more and more at various levels of in various power structures. I mean, obviously, as you can go as high as Stephen Moffat for Doctor Who, you can go as low as blogs for Doctor Who, or even lower to people who comment on blogs for Doctor Who. And it can become very messy, it can become very territorial. Mm. And when there's no money involved to sort of spur the need to do it, it really does just come down to how much you're enjoying it. And if it gets to a point where the territory and the politics just becomes too annoying, you've just got to sort of say, you know, I've got better things to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, pretty much everything that I have to say on the matter was said in the post on Cast Derberus. But, you know, the podcast is still here. We're still doing the podcast. We're still going to be talking about Doctor Who on the podcast. We're going to be talking about other things on the podcast that perhaps we may be in the past shied away from, or shied away from giving as much time to, being a Doctor Who website. I imagine, you know, once Series 9 is out of the way and there's other shows on the horizon, that we'll be talking more about other shows than we maybe would have done. You know, say 12 months ago, we might have just talked about Inferno or The Invasion. Whereas we maybe not do that now. We maybe sort of like spend a bit more time on the other shows. But we'll just see how we feel. We're not constrained by Doctor Who when Doctor Who's off air, basically. So, Under the Lake was the episode 3, which we saw last week, in which the Doctor and Clara encountered a team of base dwellers under the water, doing a whole businessy managed relationship with a piece of alien tech that had been discovered and brought onto the base. And things ended with a stunning, completely unsurprising cliffhanger when we saw the Doctor had been turned into a ghost, as per some of the other people. One of those cliffhangers that kind of get signposted in the promotion as being a really surprising cliffhanger, then all fans go away and think, what could be the most surprising thing that could happen here?
Yeah, that's what I felt.
Yeah.
It's like, if you hadn't said that, it would have been a better cliffhanger.
Sure.
But,
yeah. So, going back in time, did they go back about 100 years or something like that?
Yeah, it was more than that, wasn't it? I think they said it was 2118 or
right.
something like that.
Well, they went back to the 1980s, didn't they? A lot of people thought this was set in Russia, didn't they, when they saw clips and when there was location shooting because of all the Soviet stuff that was up there. There was a rumour going around that it was set in 70s or 80s Russia. In actual fact, obviously, as we found out, it was in a base in Scotland, a military base in Scotland that was done up to look like Russia, because people, the armed forces, military were still training for combat with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, which to some of us that would be a reasonably strong memory, and for the rest of you, you'll probably be thinking we're talking about the war. I don't know. So the setup changes. So you've basically got the same story, and you've got, you know, the Doctor's still trying to work out the same stuff that happened under the sea, but you've got a completely different location. I think this is the best approach to this so far in New Who, with this whole flip of a two-parter. What do you think?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
No.
I think it felt pretty consistent. And, you know, they've done this kind of changing the direction thing with two-parters before, such as the Silurian two-part in 2010, where the second part was a lot of talking. Although, in fairness, the first part was a lot of talking as well. But I think the second part was even more talking. The Doctor and his two friends from the future go to they basically move in time, but not in space, and they end up sort of behind the dam in this village, sort of military village setup thing, and they're looking around for what's going on. They're trying to find the source of the transmission. They find the ship, as in the first part. They find everything restored, not restored, everything as it should have been, and they bump into a chap called Prentice, who was Paul Kay, who's from the same species as David Walliams' character in The God Complex, which I thought was a nice throwback, actually. I'm not sure whether I like those characters or find them a bit ridiculous, or whether I'm supposed to find them a bit ridiculous and not care about them, or just permanently find them ridiculous. But yeah, they are a good design. So so go on then. I've given a bit of a pricey there. How are you feeling about Before the Flood?
I don't know.
Right.
To be honest, the only thing I could sum it up as is that I enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed the locations. I just felt it. I felt it betrayed the strengths of the first part.
Right.
I felt that the direction it went was far too convoluted and far too impressed with itself, when I didn't understand why it was, because the temporal mechanics it was offering was one that's been done many, many, many times before, but it was almost playing it as if this is like a really new, exciting way to do things. It's just going to blow your mind. And there's two levels I had a problem with it. One, I think there is a level to contend with of where the direction Doctor Who is going in terms of a practical problem in terms of ratings and perception. And I tend to believe that this sort of time travel interests fans, but very few other people. For a lot of people who just watch Doctor Who or watch time travel shows, and I've talked a lot about this with people, they tend to be on the position that time can be changed. That's as much as you need to know about time travel. So stories like this don't get understood, because they'll say, well, he changed time then. He died originally and he changed it. And you go, no, the whole point is that there is a mechanic here where he is setting up his own past or his own future, however you want to look at it. He never died, and they don't get it. So the nuances are lost on an audience which is at the moment extremely critical to be keeping. Now, again, it's very easy to say this was hindsight, because this show didn't come in knowing it was going to get such critically bad figures on its airing. But I think it is a problem. I think last week's would go down well with a lot of audiences, because while it was probably a bit scary for some kids, it was very straightforward in a lot of ways. It was, you know, all you needed to understand was that they were ghosts and they were being attacked by ghosts, and these ghosts might be being used as a transmitter for someone. So the story is fairly straightforward. The tropes were there. It was a horror format. It was, as everyone says, it was space under siege. So it was stuff that people could involve themselves in. This suddenly went back down the Moffat route of going extremely convoluted. And I think while the convolution for me was quite enjoyable, I didn't feel that would probably be reflected across the board. And there's a lot of things in it I didn't like. I do not like fourth wall breaking. This postmodern approach, I just don't think is needed. Yeah, we know it's a show. And yeah, I know you're sort of going on the lines of, well, you know it's a show, so we can act it like a show. We can do it like a stage and make this a soliloquy to the audience almost. Like, no, it's a different medium. It's a medium which tries to be real. Stage doesn't. And as soon as you do that, you will break it for some people, especially casual audiences who perhaps aren't interested in this sort of postmodern understanding that, you know, that this is all, a presentation, less, you know, something trying to be real. And the bookend was pointless as well, because one, it gave away exactly how the story was going to play out. It wasn't subtle enough. And two, it just wasn't needed. And it was ugly. So that really annoyed me.
Nice.
So there was a lot of things in there that I didn't like. There were things I did like. I think there was tension in there.
Yeah.
I think they initially played the Fisher King well until they exposed him into daylight. And I just think, what the hell are you doing? It's just, you spend all the time in the shadow to sort of make him look impressive. Then you shove him out into the day. You know, why? I liked the Russian base. I was a little uncertain, really, why it was there in a lot of senses, because it really didn't offer anything to the story apart from being a distraction, a nice distraction from the claustrophobic space. And again, I don't like the telephones. I think the telephones, I know it was absolutely essential for the way the story was set up, but I just don't like the constrictions of having two eras connected by a phone. It ruins it somehow. It takes away from the tension. And again, time and the TARDIS, it needs to be pulled back. This is what the show... It's funny that people don't seem to criticise the show now as they used to do for poor old Nathan Turner, you know, for his constant looks at mythology. And how much was Mordred Undead criticised, not just for its, you know, continuity mistakes, but for its over-focus on regeneration and time travel. And this is just what we're getting week after week. And it's like, you know, the TARDIS is far too involved for me. I love the TARDIS. I think it's a brilliant machine. But as soon as it's overused, it becomes too much part integral to the show. You know, the TARDIS becomes too much of a safe haven for the story. And I don't know. Are you resonating with this, or is it just...
Yeah, there is. I totally know what you're saying. I think there is too much... Certainly that story is too much reliance on the TARDIS. You know, he said back to the TARDIS like three times, I think. Mm. So, yeah, it was definitely like watching, you know, Colin Baker era or Peter Dawson era. I did feel that I agree with you with the Fisher King in, you know, once exposed into an exterior environment, didn't look quite as impressive as he did previously. But I did feel that the face-off was very Sylvester McCoy era.
Yeah, it was. And as I say, I quite liked it. I mean, I knew where it was going, but that was probably more because, as I was, funny enough, I was with my family and I was saying to them early on, they were saying, you know, my mother was there and she was going, you know, I'm just not enjoying this as much. I, you know, this seems to be silly after last week. And I said, you know, the thing is, I say I'm just a bit surprised with the Doctor, because while he knows that he can't change time, he surely is aware that he, in his position, that he can manipulate time. So what he has seen is necessarily is just an interpretation he's taken.
Yeah.
But he can construct events to create what he's seen.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, that's exactly what he does. And to be fair to the show, I preferred the fact they did that than changing time. I think changing time, he always feels a cop out. So I think it was a nice approach. Mm. I think it was very well. I think it was very well acted.
Yeah, I think that's one of the best guest casts they've had.
It's been great for the 11 years season as well, because each story so far has been great for Capaldi. He's felt far more consistent this season, which is really nice.
Yeah,
and there's some lovely little Tom Bakery looks he had in the TARDIS, which was he seemed to be really into it, which was great. I didn't feel that it really resolved the Clara issue, unless that's going to be a story arc that continues. She seemed so annoyingly confident to the point of just being callous.
It's like series two, isn't it?
Yeah, with Rose. And yeah. I know they sort of tried. They acknowledged it a little in last week with the Doctor talking to her in the TARDIS about, you know, this is my, you know, I'm the native thing. And then this week they sort of had the, Is this what you become? Were you always like this? But I don't think that still really marries with the fact that she is meant to be a compassionate character. You're either a soldier or you're not.
Mm.
And she doesn't feel like a soldier, but she doesn't act like she's compassionate either. And so you start to lose who Clara is. So I think that's a problem that they need to contend with. And the other problem I still find is that there's still horrifically bad gender writing for women, where women there was some nice women writing in there. Interestingly enough, I think as soon as a disability is involved, you can't write women in the way that you write women for television.
Mm-hmm.
because you can't play to what Buffy started, which is utilizing very smart talk, sassy smart talk,
which
can be played very well with female body language and timing and characterization to a point where it's overdone. And there was the one character there who knew about them. I can't remember her name, who was, you know, who had experience with UNIT. And she was just firing off the same sassy female character that if you'd had a man doing it, you'd have been embarrassed. You know, you're not leaving me in the TARDIS. You know, have you not met me? And you think, oh, shut up. Why are all women in these shows written like this? So, but to juxtapose that, the deaf lady seemed to be written far better.
Yeah,
because she couldn't be given those sort of lines because she couldn't do that sort of thing because of the disability. And so she became a far more real and interesting character. So that's an interesting thing within the show.
Also, because you've made her a more real and interesting character, it makes her more memorable than the one who dies.
Mm. Who just seemed to be the same sort of character we've seen for the last 10 years. And so the point when she dies, you think, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
So there are issues within there, which I think is in writing, that the show has got to stop trying to play to the sort of Buffy lineage and just know when to do that and when not to do that. And this was a story which was very smartly put together as a two-parter. As I say, I'm not sure it really works perfectly as a two-parter. I think they got to learn when to have sassy, funny characters and when not to. And a story like this doesn't need it. It works better without. And I think that was my other problem with the caretaker character, Undertaker, it just felt like a sore thumb in a story like this. The story starts off as a horror genre, and then it crosses over into, I suppose it is science fiction.
Did he really add anything, though?
He didn't.
No.
To me, it just felt again. It just seemed to take away from what the show had already been building and been building successfully.
It was just another corpse, wasn't it? At the end.
Yeah, absolutely. To be honest, I felt a bit about that with the Russian area. I liked the aesthetic of the Russian area. And I understand within the general structure of the story they've done why it had to be there. But I didn't really feel it gave anything because it only gave you two extra characters, one who was the antagonist and one who was really unneeded. And it gave some distance, but it didn't give much else. And I kind of feel in a sort of weird way, are you saying about them using the TARDIS too much? Perhaps if they'd done those conversations with Clara on a phone, the Doctor on a phone, not in the TARDIS, would have been more tense than having them do it in the TARDIS. If you know you're out there, if you'd kept them out in the Russian area and pushed the TARDIS way out of it after that, would that work better as well? I don't know. It's again, I still feel it's a show that just needs a new approach because there's just too many of the old stuff coming back. And I think you're right. I think what they tried to do this week was interesting. And in a sense, I could have been wrong. If they'd done the same sort of thing as last week, would people have just said, this is Impossible Planet, Water of Mars all over again? Is it just a base under siege till one is left? Did this add some freshness? Did it need some freshness for a second part? Maybe it did. I don't know. I agree with you, though. I think the idea of having two parties which are sort of more self-contained isn't a bad idea. This one I kind of felt it undermined the strengths of last week's. I don't know. I'll stop talking.
Okay. Well, you know, I think it's generally gone down quite well in a wider, beyond the podcast with a K. I imagine Brian hasn't yet watched it, however. Being asleep, presumably, and I know that it's it appears to have done a bit better with the overnights than other episodes, earlier episodes this year have. I will get to the point in a moment, dear listener. 4.38 viewers on the overnights,
marginally better,
yeah. But for a second part, it's a little. It is encouraging, but again, there was the World Rugby World Cup. But I can't really see that adding more than 1 million people once that's
no,
out of the way.
I think there's a lot of excuses being made here for other issues. And
So let's just make this clear: we're not making any excuses here. You know, as I say, there's 21.5% people. 21.5% of the viewing audience were watching Doctor Who. That's up from 16% last week, helped by the lower rating for the Rugby World Cup. I can't see it increasing beyond... I certainly can't see it hitting 6 million. I can't see it going far beyond 5 million at the moment. And, you know, that's not because there's anything... This isn't based on there being anything wrong with Doctor Who. I think it's more based on the direction of the show. And the time slot is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, we've been dealing with some scary stuff, but Russell T Davies wouldn't have had Doctor Who on at 8:30. And I know it's a different era, but, you know, 40 years ago, the Hinchcliffe stuff, that was on at 6:20.
Well, I know we've said it before, and I still think it's pretty crucial, but, you know, America... A show lives and dies by its time schedule, and if people don't know when a show is on, or if it's not on when they think it's going to be on, then they won't hang around or look through the schedules to find it unless they're big fans. And
do you think people still think Doctor Who's on at 7 o'clock?
Yeah, I think they'll turn on, they won't see it, they'll get distracted and go and have dinner.
Yeah, my nieces like Doctor Who. My nieces have watched some scary stuff. There's a James Moran written episode of Primeval. Which is, I think, it's from series 3. It's the first one with Jason Fleming in. And it's superbly well written. It's very scary. It's easily the best episode of series 3 of Primeval. I don't mean series 2 of Primeval. Series 3, I think. It's easily the best of that series. We mentioned this in a podcast several months ago. Because it just is so well written. It holds together well. And it's also quite scary for little ones. And my nieces still remember that episode. And, you know, that went out at like 6:30 on an evening, and arguably scarier than last week's Doctor Who as well. The point being is that you can do scary stuff earlier in the evening if you're approaching it in the right way, and it seems to be a tonal difference with Doctor Who being on at 8:30. And it's like, remember the TV movie went out at 8 o'clock, if I remember rightly, or 8:30 back in 1996, thank you.
Okay.
And, you know, again, that was tonally different. But going back to what James said about knowing when Doctor Who's on and the show's living and dying by their scheduling, Primeval was moved all over the place and could have, shouldn't have ended up going the way that it went when it went. It wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't have been a 50-year show. We maybe have had 10 years out of it at the most. But, you know, ITV moved it all over the place. ITV have got good form, or bad form, depending on which way you look at it, for moving particularly genre and cult TV programming all over the place and not giving it a solid grounding in the schedules. BBC seems to have learned from that, certainly when Doctor Who came back in 2005. And while Russell T Davies was in charge, you know, Doctor Who never started later than 7:30, apart from when the very specials were on. It was always between 7 and 7:30 when Doctor Who started, most of the time before 10 past 7. And to have Doctor Who on at 8:30, just, it doesn't seem like... It seems to me that there's a disconnect in the BBC as to what Doctor Who is.
Yeah.
And, you know, kids can't watch Doctor Who if it's on at 8:30. You know, some of them can, obviously, because, you know, they'll stay up, but the parents aren't that bothered about what they're watching. But...
Well, to put it,
do they want to be watching at 8:30? Have they found something else to do? Are they lying in bed reading when, you know, 90 minutes ago they would have been in front of the telly watching Doctor Who?
To put it into context, what time did Torchwood initially air? Was it 9?
I think it was 9 on BBC Three, yeah.
Well, you know, and that at the time was, the idea was is that, you know, kids would be in bed was the initial argument.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you're only talking half an hour before that for this, you know, this last episode.
Yeah.
Which just sort of contextualizes how late it really is in terms of but this is the case, and we've talked about this,
and just going back as well, just before you do continue, my nieces aren't watching Doctor Who
really,
yeah, because it's on too late for them.
Well, this is the problem. I mean, I think I think scheduling is a vital problem. And on top of scheduling being a vital problem, quite naturally, that lends to the question of who is the show marketed at? And who does the BBC think the show is marketed at? I mean, the problem with dwindling ratings in a show that's 10 years old, there's going to be a lot of factors. I think anyone who starts to sort of say it's because it's crap or because of X or Y, it will inevitably be because of a bit of X, bit of Y, bit of Z. But the key is to sort of try and minimize those factors when producing the show or broadcasting a show, because it's not just down to the show production. I think there are issues within the show. I think the show isn't dealing with the natural atrophy of audiences that occurs after 10 years. I don't think it's building itself up to new audiences enough. I think also its schedule isn't good enough. Its scheduling isn't certain enough. And its time of the year isn't certain enough either, and it hasn't been for 5 years. And that is another major factor. You look at America again, shows will live and die by when they're aired. You know, that is quite critical, is when you decide to air a show. And people knowing when it's going to air, they know it's going to be on the fall. Doctor Who, you know, there's still questions about even how many episodes will be next year. There's no real advancement. They have a very different PR strategy over in the States to here, and I just kind of feel that the BBC lags on this, and then gets a little annoyed when Doctor Who has bad ratings, which I think is in part to do with the show itself, but in part to do with how it's being broadcast. So I don't think it can all be laid at Moffat's door.
I think there are
issues that can be. If he wants to be the showrunner, then obviously he's got to accept certain responsibility for some of them. So, you know, it's not me being tabloid by saying blame Moffat and saying if you've got to blame someone in the production, you're going to have a showrunner. That's ultimately the person you're going to have to levy the blame at. It is a problem. And I think we're in a situation now where a year ago I'd have said, with it being such a big worldwide distributing show, there was no worry about it being cancelled, especially with worldwide having so much input. Now I could see it rested. I could see that legitimately being an issue that could
well
have.
I mean, you know, the rumors say that it's a series of four or five specials next year, so that's a rest in Doctor Who
to
terms,
a certain degree
it
is, yeah. And I would no doubt think that in part that will be a question of can we increase interest in it through a rest? Is it, and there's a certain amount of PR involved. If a show's not performing, even if it's doing worldwide, if it's not performing for BBC One and it's a BBC One show and it's considered a BBC One flagship, if it's not going to perform, do you just want to have it sitting there underperforming?
Well, that's the other thing as well. And I don't think we mentioned this before, did we? Did we talk about this previously, about, you know, how low ratings and low overnights, and you know, there is this kind of mindset among Doctor Who fans in particular that, well, it doesn't matter if it's low because everyone's watching on iPlayer. We'll disregard what's going on with iPlayer and iPlayer figures, because I think you may have mentioned that. But the fact is that the overnights do matter, and they do matter within the BBC, and especially within the senior hierarchy at the BBC, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it matters as well for other showrunners, show programmes, because, you know, prime Saturday night in the UK, Saturday night evening, tea time, is a prime time slot for television. That is a time where viewing figures are going to be high. So you're naturally going to want to be showcasing shows which you're doing well in that sort of slot. If you've got a show which is raking in four when you're expecting overnights of six, seven, eight, then it's underperforming when another show could have the chance to be performing well in that slot. So it's, to a certain degree, there is a sort of fairness in sort of saying, if a show is underperforming, should it be there?
And why? And why as well, just to an endem to this, why is Strictly Come Dancing losing the BBC about 50% of its viewers when it ends and goes into Doctor Who? Strictly Come Dancing had 8.9 million on the overnights. Then that drops to Doctor Who, 4.38 million. That's a horrendous drop-off.
I mean, you could have said at one point, maybe there's a sort of television fatigue after 2 hours or so in the last 2 weeks of Strictly, or however it's been. They've done sort of dumb bumpers, haven't they?
Right.
But in the first two episodes, they weren't.
No.
As far as I'm aware, and the same issue was occurring. So again, one has to consider, you know, what is the issues around the show? And I know we're going on about it, but I think it's obviously something which is confusing for fans, especially a lot of fans who, as you said, really enjoyed this last episode. And yet, I still think one of the problems is that the show is not formatting well for casual audiences, and it's not being scheduled properly as well for casual audiences. So I think there's two major issues there that need to be contended with.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think the overnights are important for the BBC, and I don't think fans can sit and just go, well, it was the rugby. Well, it was good weather outside. Well, people are catching up on iPlayer. I mean, the problem with iPlayer is that iPlayer is a very difficult platform to really, in my eyes, to consolidate onto figures, because you can't tell how many people are rewatching for a start. That's the most obvious thing. So, you know, you can't say, oh, well, with iPlayer, you've got an extra 1.5 million people watching, even if you believe that figure, which is questionable. Then, but how many of those are actually new watchers? How can you consolidate that with your overnights? Well, I mean, I know, you know, consolidation is a bit more, it's not necessarily about that, but I'm just kind of sort of trying to say that if you're trying to get an idea of how many people are watching, you can't just simply say the numbers in iPlayer can be added to the numbers watching on Saturday night, and then sort of say, well, the show's okay because they're just split up. So you can't say for sure that is what iPlayer is offering you as a figure, if that figure is accurate. And as far as I'm aware, the BBC doesn't actually, it has not divulged how it comes to its figures, how it, you know, it comes to that statistical number. And that, again, can be distortive. And that's what, you know, all broadcasters will do that. They're going to play, going to want their figures to show their best side. So, you know, it's nothing against the BBC. Every channel will do that. But the point is, we don't know. So it's, we can't presume that that is 1.5 extra million people just deciding, oh, well, you know, I can't watch it Saturday, I'm going to watch it Sunday. You can't decide that. So, there's a lot in the air. It's a funny situation. The other thing which I think is also interesting, which no one is really talking about, is while two-parters offer a change of format for the show, how popular is two parts to a contemporary audience? Because television is changing again. A lot of people are getting used to either, if they're not, you've got Netflix, they're using iPlayer, or they might be buying box sets more. Serialization week after week, that is a changing mode of viewing, or certainly a less popular mode of viewing. How much less popular, I can't say. I haven't got the figures. It might be marginal. But does the two-parter help the show in terms of casual people? And at the moment, it's the casual people who are critical. I don't know.
No, I agree. Okay, we're going to move on from that. I mean, if you were going to throw a figure out of 10 at Before the Flood, what would you give it?
As an extension of last week's, I would probably give it a 6, but I would give it a higher number as an episode on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it was enjoyable. I there's no denying it. I mean, it looked good, the acting was good, there was tension in there. While, as I say, I felt I kind of worked out what was going to happen, I think a lot of people might not have, or they might have been more in the moment, so they wouldn't have been trying to work it out. I think it was some bold, clever ideas. I'd probably give it, 7.5.
Okay. Yeah, that'd probably be in the same neck of the woods with both of them.
I would have given last week higher. I think last week we'd have to have been given a sort of an 8.
Yeah.
I think it was a good show. It was a good story. So it's not me trying to knock it. I don't think it lived up to what was... But I don't think it damaged it either. I think the worst thing for me was the fourth walling.
Which is interesting, because the whole fourth walling business with the bootstrap theory remind me of the Michael Moorcock story, Behold the Man, more than anything else. Which basically is, instead of someone becoming Beethoven, someone becomes Jesus.
But I mean, it's an old concept. It's not a new one.
And no.
It's played out almost with the necessity of something which you get when audiences will not have considered before. And you came to the end of it and thought, really? You fourth walled for this? And then again, as I said, it didn't need it, because it sort of gave away the structure of what was happening.
What did you think of the rock guitar intro theme tune?
That's interesting. I to be quite honest, to me it sounded like someone had a fan had overlaid a guitar on top of the tune. I imagine a lot of people loved it. It didn't do much for me, but then I don't particularly like it without it. It's too trill at the moment for me as well, the actual theme tune.
Yeah.
What about you? That was a nice one-off idea.
Yeah, it was a nice one-off idea. I thought it was nice that the roar of the Fisher King was the lead singer from Slipknot. So it kind of tied into that nicely, I thought. But, I could live without it. I might listen to it once or twice in the future, but I certainly wouldn't expect it as the main .2 theme tune. We're going to move on. James, right. And listener, a couple of things that we need to talk about. First of all, Eighth Doctor Time War.
Oh, yeah.
Which was announced a couple of days after some other overly promoted spin-off news. Time War is from Big Finish. It's due out in November 2017. Stars Paul McGann as the Doctor, as the Eighth Doctor. We don't really know an awful lot about it at the moment. Other than it's Paul McGann, and it's coming out as a multi-part box set from Big Finish. And it will no doubt, it's obviously going to be a prequel to Night of the Doctor. It's probably going to tie in some way with what we know of the Time War and the War Doctor series. There's probably going to be some links to and from between those two. This is Big Finish, so I'd be very surprised if there isn't any. So that sounds quite exciting. Did you guys talk about the War Doctor series?
We didn't, no.
Right, okay. I think we'll come back to that when Brian's back. Because we've talked about modern Doctor Who, and we're going to talk about modern Doctor Who and Big Finish now, but the War Doctor's a kind of a special sort of thing with modern Doctor Who and the Big Finish crowd. So the other thing is the Diary of River Song, which we've previously discussed when that was announced with all the other stuff like the Fifth Doctor with the Jadoon and all that other stuff and the Churchill stuff. And the Diary of River Song seems like, oh my God, they're doing that. But when you see the cast, obviously you probably know that Paul McGann's in it, but also there's Samuel West and Alexander Vlahos in it as well. So they've certainly gone to town on the casting with that, and the cover's quite a stunner. And the writers, we've got Jenny Colgan, Justin Richards, James Goss, and Matt Fitton. I did hold this sort of fantasy that maybe they'd make her less... Well, they'd maybe make River Song more likeable to those of us who aren't that keen on River Song. Having seen the people writing it, I'm not entirely confident in that now. That's not because these people are bad writers, but they seem to me to be people who are very much invested in the River Song character as fans. What do you think?
You think too about James Goss?
All four of them.
I have no issue with that. In the end, the beauty of when it's something that's commercial is that if you are not a fan of that person, you don't listen to it, you don't buy it. If you are a fan, maybe that's exactly what you need. That's what people like about her. I would have said up until a month ago, well, that's okay, because I never have to deal with her again, and they can enjoy her if they want. Alas, that's not true either.
Oh, of course, yeah. Never mind. yes, River Song's back at Christmas, of course, isn't she?
Yes.
Yes, so that's that out the way. So and that's out in January, so that's not long now, really. So it's really time to get your orders in there. And, Paul McGann's in it, so... Even if you are kind of grinding your teeth at River Song, you have got the wonderful voice of Paul McGann to back on.
I think there's always the one. What is really nice is the fact that it legitimizes him even further. I mean, obviously he has been legitimized. He was always legitimized, but it legitimizes the Big Finish brand even further and his relevancy to Doctor Who, which, while he's obviously, like Colin Baker, had a renaissance, thankfully, through Big Finish, you still kind of feel that he was given the short straw by losing the opportunity to play the Doctor properly. Yeah. So anything that sort of gives him a bit of a bit of relevancy to the whole franchise, I think is always kind of cool.
Yeah, I agree. And just the last thing, it's a bit of sad news, unfortunately. Because it's been reported that Doctor Who stuntman extraordinaire who founded the agency Havoc, Derek Ware, has passed away. He was involved with Doctor Who right at the beginning. He arranged the fight between Cal and Zar in the 100,000 BC story. He was involved in the UNIT years, most famously, especially the Ambassadors of Death. And so that's a bit of sad news, because he was very important to the early years of Doctor Who. And you know, I mean, some of those setups that they had with Havoc were absolutely fantastic. So rest in peace, Derek Ware. Anything to add to that?
No, not really, unfortunately. No?
Okay. Right. So this is the time where we do recommendations, but as it was mentioned last week, we're not doing those anymore. On Air Revolution, power to the people. So I think what we'll probably do in future is if someone has a recommendation, then they can just, you know, go ahead and mention it. Otherwise, just carry on about our business.
This is a, as you said at the beginning, you know, we've moved on from Custodes, which means things can change. And if people have any input and want to say what they want to hear.
I just said totes. Sorry about that, everyone.
I tried to talk.
I will say, I got a copy of the After Lif by John Lloyd and John Cantor, which is the latest version of The Meaning of Lif, which was by John Lloyd and Douglas Adams. There's your Doctor Who link. Which is, it's available in The Works for £2.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, you've got 200 pages of words giving meanings to things that don't have meanings, such as Tutagaruk, noun, one who retweets praise about themselves. Oh, that's the sort of thing Blog to Who does. Anyway, so if you're listening and you've been taking notes, we'll be back next week around the same time. Until then, it's goodbye.